Welcome to In the Deep. I'm your host, Catherine Ingram. The following session was recorded in Victoria, Australia on March 15th, 2026. It's called Habitual Calm. We will be scheduling some Zoom sessions over the next few months. Please join our mailing list, katherineingram.com, to be informed of that schedule. You know how you have muscle memory when you've done a movement so many times that you don't think about it? And you really notice it particularly when you say you're in a car and the blinker is on the opposite side of what you're used to, right? And how many times do you end up turning the wipers on instead of the blinker? So many things, you know, having been over here for 10 years, when I go home to visit in the States, I'm forever trying to get into the driver's seat. You know, and my family's always, "You're not driving." Muscle memory is very powerful. There's another way, though. There's a kind of mind memory that can occur. You know how they say that when you do something 10,000 times, you hit a level of mastery? Maybe not everybody, maybe it doesn't take 10,000 for everybody, but as a general rule. Well, so it is with resetting your awareness. Resetting your awareness into presence or into gratitude or into just a very pure awareness. These words are only fingers pointing to the moon. That too can be a similar kind of habit to the non-thinking muscle memory habit, whereby you're so used to dipping back if you're lost. There's a way that the mind just automatically resets if the habit is strong. So what I'm talking about and what I've been talking about all these weeks is developing a habit of presence. Not having to practice it, just as you're not really practicing which side of the car to get on. It's the habit. There was a Cambodian monk named Mahagosananda. Long time meditator, let's say, living in monasteries, great master. And toward the end of his life, he had dementia. But he would still show up. I don't know for how long that lasted, but even while he was in the beginning stages of dementia, he would show up and give teachings. And often he would just chant the suttas. And that there was this vibe about him, I heard. I didn't see him in that phase. That the vibe was still very chilled out from a lifetime of habit. We can assume that he wasn't using a kind of intellectual application to be in that chilled out state. It was his longtime habit. So, the importance of allowing the attention to just go to the safe place, right? Not indulging the nightmare, all the fears, all the dramas, all the me, 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 me. To really allow the attention to, I'd like to say the word sink. It's not quite exactly right, perhaps, but just sink to the calm of the being, to go deep into the calm. Yesterday, I had a moment of what you could call terror. I felt that I was in a kind of mind meld with the terror that's happening on planet Earth. And it wasn't specific to war or any particular terror. It was the general terror. the samsaric terror that's going on all the time. And it was like I had this moment where the mind, unbidden, it was like I had taken a gigantic gulp of terror. And I felt this feeling coming over me of just abject fear, and no doubt a lot of people are experiencing that in real time. And in that moment, I shook it off. I shook it off, not in denial, but in a recognition I can't really afford to indulge this, and there's no point, right? There's no point in me just being terrified. But fortunately, I do have this habit of coming back to calm, coming back to freedom, coming back to presence. I do have that long time habit. So it wasn't a big stretch for me to get right back to that. I can imagine for many people who don't have that habit, when terror overcomes in even a moment, it's not that easy to shake it off. And we see the results of people who are at the effect of their internal terror, whether it's writ large, whether they're out rampaging around and doing terrible things to lots of people, or even just internally collapsing into depression, anxiety, and madness. We can see how that could happen and does happen. The good news here is that your possibility is that you can reset quickly. And even if you have to do that many times a day, you're headed up to your 10,000. I always say, even if you have to choose freedom 10,000 times, that's 10,000 tastes of freedom. Might as well. And in the meantime, you're building a strong habit. So I'm saying that no matter what the story is that has haunted you, one does not have to indulge it. You don't have to make a big, fancy, tidied up, happy story out of it. You can just not indulge the misery and keep yourself well-tuned as an instrument for anyone else.
Well, opportune occasion, this one, because I arrived with a question.
Oh.
And it was about stories.
Yes.
And it was about, how do you deal with the stories? I got one this week, quite a big one. The story was, I am weak.
Physically or mentally?
In every way.
Every way.
Every way. That's how it came to me anyway. Mm.
By the way, I want to say something to that very point.
Mm.
It takes a certain courage to just say that in a group of people. It does.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah. Sounds strange.
Yeah,
fair enough.
It does.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah, well, it's a big story. I think we all have our own stories running. So I don't feel like that brave. So thank you for that. That was timely.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
I mean, my way with dealing with those stories is I have a little process that I can sort of apply to them, and it's not dissimilar to what you said. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, thank you for that.
Good.
Mm. And as you said, like saying it, now that I've said it, I'm glad that it's out. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Out in the air.
Mm-hmm. Huh. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm.
Are you sure that's true, that you're weak?
Oh, I'm sure that I've believed it to be true, absolutely.
Yeah, but are you sure it's true?
No, it's not true. It's a lie.
Okay.
It's a fabrication.
It's some way in which your way of seeing yourself holds it that way. And maybe it just isn't true.
Sorry?
Maybe it's just not true or not entirely true.
Oh, well, I'm sure I'm not as strong as others in different ways.
Yeah, but I mean, to say I'm weak indicates almost a kind of completeness about it.
Yes, totally. Yeah.
Perhaps in moments we're all weak, isn't it? I mean,
Oh, yes, it's not to take away the fact that, yes, I am at times, but this is a story that I am, you know, that.
Those are very important to watch, those kinds of defining stories about oneself, labels that is all the fashion to label all kinds of mental things and, you know, the big identity movement. And, you know, it's very important to not necessarily buy into any kind of fixation like that on your identity.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, my idea is to buy out of it, not into it.
Yeah, yeah.
But I've been in it since God knows when.
Yes.
Because I can feel it. I can literally feel it in my bones.
Yeah, it's interesting just to even challenge the concept of I. Not only I am this or I am that, I am weak, whatever. Go to the I source and ask, what's that?
Yeah, well, that's another question.
Yes, it is. It can shut you up. Because you don't know. Like, one of the powers of the who am I question is that it'll just quiet the mind. Like, you go into the mystery. Mm. Who or what am I? Close your eyes and ask that question. Almost anything you're going to say is going to be limited.
Thanks for the opportunity. Mine doesn't belong to me, but it's intersected with me for almost 10 years now. And about 10 years ago, I met a man who was then in immigration detention who had a terrible torture and trauma history. And I knew some of this, but couldn't really talk at a deep level because the language wasn't there. And anyway, as we kind of got to know each other, there was this statement he made about himself. I'm 100% bad. There's nobody as bad as me. And that kind of took my breath away because what I wanted to say immediately was, you don't strike me as that person, but the system you're in strikes me as a very bad system.
And let me understand, is he the torturer?
No, he was.
The torturee.
And so I was studying narrative therapy at the time, and I started working with him, you know, through a process. And then he kind of got to 30% bad, which was an interesting, like, how do you come up with these
numbers? That's a huge improvement.
But I think there was more the growing realization that the system was bad. And he knew the system was bad, but he had somehow absorbed himself into something that was purely universal about him. And I suppose my question is, when we talk about resets, I look at him and I still know him and I'm still close to him. And it's very hard to ask somebody to reset from something, you know, like that. But, you know, I'm in a very powerful position to reset for myself. So my ability to reset from that is absorbing a lot of, you know, quite difficult stuff, is to reset into safety, is it reset into an idea of myself as separate from this, because I've absorbed so much of the story.
Yes.
Then it's almost become, you know, the way I live my life. It's not a question per se. I think it's just a an observation that a reset can be a huge challenge. And I think when I first met him and I'd asked him to reset from 100% bad, it would have been terrible because he was very attached to that story.
And
I was just really thinking about the nature of reset and how often you need to tell yourself, I am kind or I am beautiful or I am good, until it starts to feel a little bit more comfortable, you know, that you can actually live with that new story. And even for him, the idea of freedom was so remote for him that when he became free, there was still not a sense that he was free.
Right.
So, yeah, I think I just wanted to put that out there as a sort of an observation about the nature of how available is a reset. It's always available, but it's more challenging. And somehow when you get absorbed in somebody else's story, pulling yourself apart, resetting as a sovereign person can be quite difficult, particularly with this sort of work.
To your point about your own reset, And I know it sounds like from your work you would be well aware of this, but I think the most powerful help to anyone who's in a kind of mind nightmare is to be in the company of someone who isn't, right? It's just so helpful. You know, Thich Nhat Hanh used to use when he was alive an example of if you're on a boat, a little rowboat with a few people, and you observe that the boat has sprung a leak, if everybody panics, you've got a high likelihood of drowning. But if one person stays completely calm, that calm transmits, and you have a lot better chance of surviving. You have your full complement of mental wherewithal to work with, instead of much of it being in panic, in which case you're practically paralyzed. So that's in general true, that when you're exuding calm, it's calming to others. It doesn't always necessarily work, but it has a good chance.
And the thing that struck me about you saying that is that choosing to be calm also calms the part of yourself that's not calm.
Sure, exactly. Yes, yes.
Just with other people.
That's right, yes. Yeah. I used to call my sessions when I would put up posters back in the day, a long time ago, choose freedom.
Choose freedom.
Yeah, just simply choose freedom. Like whatever nightmare or problem or whatever, just remember that. Choose freedom in this moment.
Thank you.
I also don't have a question, but I just wanted to just acknowledge you. It feels the same, and I'm just grateful to be here.
It's
lovely to see you, Catherine.
Oh, you too.
I have very fond memories of sitting with you and it just being very coherent stillness within myself. And, you know, I remember those times with great fondness.
Mm.
It's lovely to see you.
Yeah, you too, yeah.
Feels like a big time in the world right now. And I found myself this last week just feeling less of the micro and a lot of the macro. And like my internal feel is like being moving through big anger and like underlying grief. And like I've had that feeling anyway in response to what's been happening in Palestine, but now it feels like it's extending out in a broader, more, it's just feels really big. And like I feel myself almost kind of getting ready for a bigger change in response to what's happening in Western civilization and how we're all a part of that. And it feels like there's very substantial and fundamental shifts in the foundations of what we exist within.
Absolutely.
And I can feel myself like wanting to be ready for my family.
Yeah.
And
I sure understand. Yeah. I think a lot of people are feeling this. For me, it feels different than in my lifetime. And I've lived through a lot of very troubling historical moments and phases. I was a kid in the Cuban Missile Crisis when we used to have to train for a possible nuclear strike. We had the lamest training. We'd have to like get under our desk and But many times since, of course. But this feels different. It does. And who knows? I mean, lots of times I've felt, oh boy, how are we going to get out of this pickle? And then we did. We limped along, kept going, you know. But this one feels big. Your job really remains the same. You're the calm horse. Whatever happens. We have very little control now. I'd say there's no one on earth, no matter whose name you mention, because no one can predict things that are unforeseen. It can go any old way. So we certainly have very little, we don't have a lever that's going to do much or anything. But we can, in our own world, in our own circumstances, with our own people, our people that we live with, that we interact with, our friends, our family, we can be the calm port. And the human spirit is just astonishingly strong, as we know from history, from people who have just stared down the dragon over and over and over again. So the only way you can do that is if you're just quiet inside, if you're just basically in service and being very unmoving in that. Not that you don't have your private moments. Before you came today, I talked about yesterday having this moment of just terror. My mind went into, I hadn't felt it, I think, maybe ever in my life. It was almost like it was the collective scream. That's kind of what it felt like in that moment. And I reset my attention because I knew I don't want to hang out in this space. And not only was it incredibly uncomfortable and horrifying, like the worst nightmare, but I knew this is going to be no good to anyone. Not only do I want to get myself out of this, it's not going to be helpful. And so I did, and I talked earlier before you came about just the power of habit, of how you're using your attention. What is your habit? What is the default position of your attention? So if it keeps flowing back to, I've got one thing I have to remember, pretty much, you just keep that one thing, choose freedom, choose peace, choose love, keep it simple. And then whatever is to be, that is how you'll meet it. Did you know Ram Dass? You know who Ram Dass was? Of course, yes. He was also an old friend of mine, and I interviewed him a couple of times. And the first time I interviewed him was in the 80s, in the time when we were in the Cold War, which now seems like a walk in the park, frankly. I was like, because we also had the mutually assured destruction understanding, the MAD, as it was known. And because, you know, the Russians love their babies too, as Sting or somebody sang. And anyway, I said to Ram Dass, are we facing Armageddon, do you think? Or are we entering the new age of peace and love? And he said, well, if we're facing Armageddon, the best way to go into that is to quiet the mind and open the heart. And if we're facing the new age, yeah, quiet the mind and open the heart. And so to really understand deeply that that's really your position. And if people think you're being superficial or whatever, let them, it's fine. You know, if people think this is not a time for peace and love, well, whatever they need to be doing in their life is their business. Now, I know that part of my freedom as a civilian is that a lot of other people had to fight in wars and different things had to be settled in different harsh ways, horrible ways. So I'm aware of that. I'm aware of my privilege in that regard. You know, I'm not going to be called upon to defend the homeland or anything like that. But while we're in this position of privilege where we can be sort of the priest caste or the Dharma tribe, while we can do that, it's so, so beneficial to others, to ourselves and others, to your children. Very important for the two of you to exude peace and calm. Very important.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, because part of the nightmare is that you feel like everyone else is in the nightmare. Like, however bad the thing is, if you feel like everybody is just going crazy in terror, that's an additional part of the horribleness of it.
Yeah, it's true. We can anchor something different.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. And it doesn't negate our feeling collapsed sometimes or falling into grief. One time, one of my friends was at one of the Kali chakras with the Dalai Lama in the 80s. And during the Kali chakra, which is a long ritual process that goes on, I guess, a whole day and maybe 2 days or something, anyway, sometime in this long period, during one of the breaks, somebody handed the Dalai Lama a letter, and in this letter was very sad news, because the Dalai Lama and the Tibetans would have been, unfortunately, privy to a lot of terrible things that were happening to their countrymen. And on their behalf, like, because they were aligned with the Dalai Lama and the other people in exile. Anyway, on this break, he read this letter, not out loud, but he read it and he had it on his lap and he cried. And my friend who witnessed this said, to see the Dalai Lama cry, there's an intensity to that in terms of like a possible collapse in yourself, like, oh my goodness, this must be really bad. But then after some time, he returned to the procedures and just blasted out, just bright, like powerful, loving, just there again, his habit and him knowing his place and knowing what his real job was. Yeah. Yeah. I always loved that. I felt very privileged to hear that story. Another time, I was in Los Angeles, and some monks had done, at a museum, they had done this sand mandala, big, gigantic one. Do you know the sand mandalas? So for those who don't, it's when usually a Tibetan monk and group of monks, they create an image of a mandala made of sand, and it's actually executed by these little dribbles, these little tool things that just dribble colored sand. It's very tedious, actually, and slow going. It's not like just big brush strokes, just dribbling a few of sand, and then they create this entire huge thing. And then, after some designated time, a senior monk will come along in a ritual way and just take a broom and brush through the whole thing. This is a way of showing the impermanence of all things. It's like a very powerful visual effect. So on the day of the brush through, a few people were invited along with the Dalai Lama to come and witness that, and I happened to get invited. And so we were there, and it was a kind of crowded space in this room. And so the Dalai Lama came in, and I was standing quite near a woman in a wheelchair who was very, I don't know what she had, but she was quite disabled, and her movements were out of her control, really. So she was kind of just, you know, moving randomly all through herself in sitting in this wheelchair. And I happened to be standing near her as he came in, and he stopped. Now, most of the crowd couldn't see this because he wasn't on a stage or anything. He was just walking through a crowd. But I was right there. And he looked down at her. He held her head in his hands. He put his forehead to her forehead and just sort of stood there for a while, just radiating, transmitting calm. What a moment for her, like for the rest of her life, you know, whatever her life might be, she had this moment. Michael was telling me yesterday, like what was it called? An angel moment? A moment? What's it called? The one-minute angel, yeah. Times in your life when you've either been the recipient or the one-minute angel yourself, that you show up in a way that is a moment that's unforgettable in a beautiful way. And I was so happy to have witnessed that, because then he carried on to the business at hand of the monks sweeping the mandala. I guess my point is, as it was at the very beginning today, your habit of freedom, your habit of exuding that kind of presence is, one could make the case that it's probably the most valuable thing there is, right?
Because in truth, it's what we actually do have some degree of control within.
Yes, like exactly.
The rest is taking place, and we'll wait and see how it
plays out. Right. But your relationship to everything, yes, is how you're framing it in your awareness and how you're responding.
Hello, I've been to some of your things before, retreat in Blackburn. I don't know how many years.
Oh, yes.
Anyway, the questions I had in my heart to, address, you've already answered.
That does happen.
Just that sense of what can you do and be to be meaningful in these times? And, I knew that I wanted to be in the presence of a role model for these things, and that's you. Mm. And, I'm just very happy. I was aware of all the many occasions that you've held these gatherings, and I was aware this was the last chance in this series. So I'm very glad to be here.
I'm so glad you came. So, of course, again, I'll reiterate, when you keep it very simple about what to do and how to be, it becomes quite effortless.
Yes.
If you thought there was something else, some big thing that you had to do, well, good luck.
Well, that's the thing I is a challenge for me to validate.
Mm-hmm.
Just being that calm person.
Yeah.
And there's an expectation in society in general to be industrious and busy and achieve and all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And
I always say, how's that working out? I mean, if you step out and just see the whole samsaric picture, you realize this is just an unfolding. We're not talking about, I don't know who's or what or how or anything, it's a mystery, but it's just a gigantic unfolding. And of course, we as human creatures who think we have great agency want to tweak it. There's still some room for improvement. But I think it's very important to say yes to your moment here in history, in time, in this brief light that we are here in this particular form, and this is what we've got, and we can absolutely make the best of it in terms of how we are feeling in it, how we are being in it, what we're offering, without an idea that the offering has to be received. As long as you let that one go, then you're really home free. You really offer it freely. There's a saying, perhaps in Sanskrit or in Hinduism somewhere, give it all to God, just every action. What happens is not your business.
I realized something about equanimity, which I've always sort of scratched my head about. And the idea of it is very attractive,
mm-hmm.
right? This watching, bearing witness to what happens, and and sort of being equanimous with that. And yet the idea of being equanimous with what's going on feels wrong, in a sense, right? Like, how do we allow that? What do we do? And I suddenly had the realizations that the equanimity is not on the emotional level. That the I always thought that the application of it will be correct, appropriate.
Yes.
When you just watch whatever unfolding, and it's neither good nor bad.
Right,
there's no engagement on an emotional level. And I suddenly realized, no, the equanimity is the being okay with it's more of a mental kind of fluctuation piece,
right. Right,
which I'm not disturbed by it on a mental level.
Right.
But I do very much
passionate.
Care,
yes.
and engage with this. And so I'm just sort of sitting with that, like this idea that I tended to assume that if I get upset about it, it's because it's wrong.
Right.
And I get upset because I want that to be different.
Yes.
But the upset is on the bearing witness level rather than the judgment.
Absolutely. To really feel passionate about things that you're seeing that are unjust. I mean, of course, that's why I titled my book that I wrote many years ago, Passionate Presence, because just simply presence was a bit passive in my view. I could see how confusion could come in to just thinking, well, it's just one to me is everything, you know, one to me is death and life and harm and non and but all of that, you know. No, you can have a very passionate feeling and remain equanimous on a sort of meta level, such that you are still dedicated to the greater good, and you're going to be very careful, despite your own passionate feelings, about how you behave and what you say. Because you're in a deeper equanimity, you become the ultimate diplomat, in a sense, even though you might be seeing something in a very troubling way. That's exactly what that's the kind of person you want to be doing negotiations. Someone who deeply feels, isn't just laissez-faire of us, oh, well, it's all one anyway, no big deal. That's what I'm saying. There's a lot of spiritual bypassing that can occur with these kinds of understandings. That's why I called my book Passionate Presence. That there are things we feel, lots of things we feel passionately about. And yet, there can be another channel that is operating, that's kind of the back end of the operation, that's basically saying, let's keep it calm. Let's watch the words and the actions. And sometimes one gets out the sword, metaphorically. Sometimes something has to be said that's difficult and is powerful and it can seem harsh, but you're in service. It's nothing you should relish, you know, it's nothing that one would be happy to do, but rather that you have no other choice.
I really appreciate that reflection. Thank you. And yeah, those fond memories for me back in the day, pre-children, really, I felt grounded in this appreciation of that.
Mm-hmm.
Because presence, not necessarily passivity. I don't find that. I find I can be very present, but still activated for whatever is happening and alive in that moment.
Yes.
And I always love that reflection because I'm an activist at heart. It's like this is alive in me.
Yeah.
And I want to see the world a better place for the children and for all children.
Sure.
And what was reflected before in my reflections was that we can be that but still remain equanimous.
Yes.
And we don't have to be passive in response to what's happening.
And we don't have to be violent.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Yes, yes.
And at the same time, like, I've been doing some shadow work and looking at unconscious patterns. and honoring all parts of myself, even the parts of me that get really angry,
mm-hmm.
and seeing that in consciousness and not trying to hide it or allow it to play out in a way that's violent, mm-hmm. or, you know, the bully in me, power over, but coming to terms with the fact that that is here,
right?
But bringing awareness to it,
yeah.
and allowing it to maneuver through life in a way that's healthy and alive and awake.
Yeah.
So, like, I still want to honor my anger because I do feel angry,
mm-hmm.
and I feel grief-stricken and all of those things. But, yeah, I want to remain that anchor of peace.
Absolutely.
Amidst
yeah.
all of that.
Yeah, you can experience those feelings of anger and all of the grief and all of those as like surface waves, like a storm on the surface.
And because then it feels properly honored as well. It's like it's not repressed,
not
or it's
repressed.
Not like it's wrong. I don't, like, I have been in the habit in the past of bypassing spiritually, going, oh, that's all.
It's just a dream.
It's just,
and all of that.
And like, that's like that doesn't work for me. Like, that's just feels.
That never works for
me. I'm not telling the truth. Right? Yeah. Like, I want to tell the truth.
Yes, absolutely. This has been In the Deep. Please visit our website, katherineingram.com, where you can make a donation, tax deductible in the United States, and where you can book a private session or join our mailing list to be informed of upcoming events, such as some Zoom sessions that we're going to be having soon. We'd also appreciate a review on any platform of your choice. Till next time.